Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 193 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, it's a photographer special. We got Ethan Glading checking in from France. We got Bruce Buckley checking in from nature. We got Michael Bodenheimer from down in New Orleans, and myself. We're talking about what it's like being a photographer for cycling events in these times. And then we go into some more stories about just being a photographer in general out there covering cycling. And then we even get into a little gear talk at the end. This episode, as all of our episodes, brought to you by the Wide Angle Podium Network, which Cyclocross Radio is a part of. I'd ask you to go to wideanglepodium.com, check out all of the great shows. Everybody's producing wonderful content, updating on a regular basis. We would love you to be part of that community by joining and donating, and you can do that at wideanglepodium.com. The other big ask I have for you is we're putting up a lot of content over on the Wide Angle Podium YouTube channel. Just posted today a block or charge video that was a lot of fun that I did with Tim from Slow Ride Podcast and also with Elliot Caldwell, who's a frequent Wide Angle Podium contributor. Little guy Matt from the Slow Ride is putting up these wonderful race previews you should check out. We got a game show, cycling game show, WAP Thinks up there. A lot of cool stuff, a lot more to come. So head over to youtube.com/wideanglepodium and hit the subscribe button. It's not going to spam you. You're not going to get notifications unless you want to, but it allows us to reach a goal that will give us the ability to monetize the channel. And that's really what we're looking for. Once we can do that, we can even broaden the cycling media we're giving to you even more, bigger and better, much like this episode of Cyclocross Radio, which is 193. Talking to Ethan and Bruce and Michael, and we're doing that right now. All right, we are back in the, I don't know, I guess this is a different kind of pit. It's still the media pit, more the photographer's pit. We got Ethan checking in from France and Bruce checking in from points unknown out in nature. And Michael is here as well. And we're talking cameras. We're talking getting around races in today's environment. And yeah, Michael, where should we start?
Well, I just want to say that maybe instead of the media pit, this is a stable. This is a stable for lens jockeys.
Oh, my Lord.
And Ethan's checking out.
Ethan's wondering what he got himself into.
And can it be our scrum? It could be a scrum.
Well,
I think we're only allowed virtual scrums now. I don't think we're allowed actual scrums at this point in history.
Bruce, that's an amazing segue, like the scrum, right? So let's kick it off. Saturday was the return of the UCI World Tour with Strade Bianche. Amazing race. I mean, I don't know how much we'll go into that, but I'm sure everybody's number one pick, Wout, he won. And I was really interested in the live stream watching the post-race finish. How exactly was the media going to operate, you know? If I think of Amstel Gold last year when Vanderpool won and he comes ripping into the media scrum, and it's like a rugby match, the amount of photographers and handlers and press people around him. And like Christophe Ramon gets that shot where he's like on the ground, like maybe got knocked over shooting through someone's leg like that. If you watch that now, like you kind of get the heebie-jeebie because you're like, whoa, people are just all over themselves and touching. And so now it's like looking at what happened at Strade Bianche. Like I saw one photographer in the, like shooting photos of Wout when he was like dousing himself with a water bottle, and it's just a completely different atmosphere. And I don't know. Like, I guess I'm just curious, like how photographers are going to get through this, what we're going to see on social media and media. Like, I don't know. I'm just curious to hear you guys' thoughts and you know, Ethan too. I'm really curious because, like I said, you're there in Europe and you maybe will have firsthand experience soon, and you can, you know, regale us.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't been to a race since Paris-Nice, although I guess that was sort of a race that happened during COVID time, because there was, I was there while it was, you know, each day it was sort of progressively shutting down more and more. But yeah, watching Strada, it was really, I almost felt bad for Wout to win in that atmosphere, because it, yeah, the finish line shot, there's no fans. You know, usually the fans in the background add so much energy to those photographs. You see people screaming their heads off, and there was just nobody there. It was kind of, it was a little bit sad in a way. The other thing was, you know, they had the, so normally at a race like that, you know, they come up that super steep hill, and then the photographers are usually pretty close to the line because it's clearly not going to be a sprint. And I noticed this time they put the photographers way back. And I think, you know, if you look at the finish line shots, they look like they were shot from overhead. But in some of the shots, I could see where they actually were, and they were not on any kind of elevated platform, or at least not, the majority of them were not. They were just up the hill a lot further. And I don't know, it's very strange. That seemed unnecessary to me, although maybe they have a way to get the riders off the finish straight before they got to the photographers. Maybe that was the idea.
So are you looking for like 400 millimeter lenses now, if this is going to be the case?
Well, look, I have one camera that has a crop sensor. So with my 70 to 200 on there, it's a 300. And then I can put a teleconverter on there, and it's like a 4 something. So yeah, I think I'm going to be breaking that thing out a lot more if this goes on like this.
Ethan, what do you shoot? Are you Canon?
No, I'm a Nikon guy.
Oh, I like this. Okay, good. This is we're kind of covering a lot of the bases here.
Although I should say when I say I'm a Nikon guy, that's what I've been shooting with for a long time. But I'm not a Nikon like fanboy. I'm kind of system agnostic. You know, if Nikon went out of business tomorrow and somebody told me I had to shoot Canon, then so be it. Or Sony. It would just take a while for me to get. Yeah, I like the Nikon ergonomics. That's about it. All the photos that come out of all those cameras now are all top notch. There's no anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen your photos, I've seen Bruce, Bill's. I mean, they're all, I mean, obviously there's a Sony look. I can tell when I look at photos, and I can tell if it's a Sony camera. It's really interesting. It sort of manifests itself in the bokeh, you know, like the background, it has a certain like pattern. It's really interesting. But yeah, I mean, that's interesting thinking about the zoom length and how you cover these races. And Bill, you were talking about one of Christophe Ramon's photos of Wout, and just, you know, the background. And so the other aspect, I guess, is the fans too, interactions with the fans. Some of these races we've seen a lot of people wear masks, and some in this photo that Christophe pointed, there's no mask. So, I mean, like, also as a photographer, you are in there, and like, you know, in a cross race, we're running around the course and we're squeezing between people. So there is that element too, as a photographer, like you are putting yourself in situations that maybe you don't want to be into. I mean, is that going to affect the shot? You know, like, are you going to miss a shot? Cause you're like, do I really want to go squeeze through that crowd? But maybe there won't be a crowd. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, honestly, I'm probably not going to shoot any really big races this year. Just economically, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me. So I'm going to be at the smaller races. And that mainly has to do with the restrictions that are in place around the start and the finish. So I won't be able to get in the team bus area at the start of a big race. Won't be able to get in the team bus area at the finish of a race. Won't be able to get in the area where the soigneurs are with the riders at the finish of a race. I mean, that's like, it's at least half my shots from a day normally.
Yeah, especially if you're working for a team, that's the kind of stuff that they want, all the behind the scenes and just sort of lifestyle type shots.
Exactly. So at the smaller races, I'll still be able to do that, I think. I've been in touch with a race that I'm shooting starting on Friday, and they haven't given me any guidelines or restrictions as far as where I can go or what I have to do. I was thinking that I was going to put in my credential request and I was going to get a request for a negative COVID test or something, but they haven't said a word about it. So I'm just going to show up and hope for the best. But I think that the smaller races are going to, they just don't have the crowd size. So they're not going to have the same restrictions in place. There's not going to be, you know, there's not going to be a scrum of thousands of fans trying to get autographs and things at the smaller races, at like the 2.2s and 1.2s, 1.1s. So those are the races that I'll be checking out. And I'm not, I'll have a mask and everything, but I'm not expecting to have to like fight my way through a big crowd. It just doesn't make sense for me risk-wise to do that. I'm not going to get the photos that I need, and so I'm not going to put myself at risk.
What's the race you're going to shoot coming up?
It's the Tour of Savoy and Mont Blanc. So it's in the Alps. It should be beautiful. The scenery should be amazing. I think it's traditionally a U23 race, although there are some bigger teams there this year. Rally should be there.
Oh, cool.
Who else? Arkea Samsic should be there. There's a few Pro Conti teams. I think they probably were having trouble getting international U23 squads there, so they opened it up a little bit.
And you said you were offered a moto.
Yeah, which is really unusual here for me. I don't normally. There's normally at a race that size, there'd be one, maybe two motos. And I'm not high enough the pecking order in France to get one of those. So,
hey Ethan, what's your take on using motos right now and having to like be hugging a moto driver as a photographer in pandemic times?
I'd be a little concerned. I would wear a mask. I suppose I would hope that I would want that person to wear that. I would want the pilot to wear a mask. I know that. So I see a lot of stuff on Twitter about bike races in the U.S. And I have to say my take on the risk is a little different from what a lot of people seem to be saying. I've been looking at a lot of epidemiological studies, and there's almost no outdoor transmission in those kinds of environments. There's been no clusters that have come up because of things like that. I think if I were wearing a mask and the driver were wearing a mask, I really wouldn't be too concerned.
Yeah, I don't know that I feel as comfortable with you as you on that. I wouldn't feel comfortable hugging you either right now. I'll hug you another time, I promise. But I don't know. We don't know what we don't know. But I mean, being that close, like we literally find ourselves hugging these drivers at some points. You know, I mean, we try not to, but at some points you're pretty much.
I don't think I've ever done that, Bruce, but that's fine. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Go ahead. But anyway, I know I have when we've almost like really grab. But anyway, I mean, your head is within a foot of that driver. So I have actually thought about this when we started talking about some events in the U.S. that were on the fence about whether they were going to happen, and they would have involved me being on a moto. And I thought to myself, like, if this goes forward, would I be okay with that moto? Could I come up with another, you know, another option? And and at that time, I really felt like I didn't feel comfortable with the moto. I feel like we don't know. It's such a novel virus that we don't understand.
You might say it's a novel coronavirus.
It is that. Yes.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I mean,
accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. It's a concern for sure. I don't know if the staff of these races, if they've been tested or what's going on. But then again, you know, even here in France, where I think the testing situation is pretty good, you know, you're still, you don't get your results immediately. I don't think you get your results within 48 hours even. So you could pick it up after you get your test, you know, and then still have it, you know, at the race. So, and I think we've seen that at races with riders where they've had negative tests, you know, a day or two before the race, they get to the race, and then a stage into the race, they test positive. So yeah, you don't know. I agree.
What's and this is not Corona related, but I've never ridden on a moto, and it sounds like you guys both have. I'm really curious, like, what's that like, being a photographer? And are you shooting from the motorcycle? Are you going to a spot, getting off and shooting, doing both? I mean, I don't know. Tell me what that's like. Walk me through that experience.
Well, there's different styles for sure. I mean, I like to hug my driver and Ethan doesn't. So there's that.
So that means one of you tips more and the other one doesn't and maybe gets better photos. I don't know.
I consider my hug a tip. But that's a nice little bonus. Hey, what's wrong with that? We all need a hug every now and then. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the race. Sometimes the race doesn't want the... every race has a slightly different policy or feel to it. Because, you know, where the motos go and how they move through the race is kind of up to the officials. But yeah, I honestly don't love riding on a moto. And I don't always prefer it. If it's an easy race to get around using my car, I almost always prefer to do that. I don't find that I get a lot of great shots from the moto in the race. Especially because I'm usually not on, there's a hierarchy among the motos, and I'm not usually on the first couple motos, and they're going to be the ones, they're going to be right in front of the breakaway or right in front of the pack at sort of the critical moments of the race. So if you're not there, you know, you're not getting super, you know, if you're not getting that critical moment, then I don't know. It's not always worth it. And it's pretty exhausting to sit on one of those things for like 6 hours. Especially when it's hot.
And I guess also it's like you have to have a relationship with the driver, right? I mean, sort of, I'm like thinking through like, you know, how you communicate like, hey, let's stop. Like, I guess if you could stop, but like where to go, where to move, like they're like either you're just completely up to the moto and he kind of puts your lens where he wants, or Bruce, you seem to, you got something.
I was just going to say on that when I've had the opportunity, like, sometimes it's not assigned ahead of time and there's sort of a pool of drivers there and I walk up and we just sort of do this matchmaking game. And if it's somebody who's been my driver before and I found them to be safe and a really good steady driver, I'd go with the known. I would go with somebody I know, but it's not always that easy to like be able to request somebody or the person people you know, there may not be anyone there that you know. So you kind of just got to, so you say there's a relationship. I mean, it's not always the same drivers, at least for me. They get who they can get sometimes at these events, especially in the US. And sometimes you get up there and it's somebody you know and you say, hey, I know you, you're a good driver, you're safe. This is going to be a good day. Can we work together? And that's how I've done it. But yes, there is a relationship. I'd rather know the driver and know what I'm getting into if I can.
Yeah. In Europe, it's a little different. It wouldn't be different for me. I would have to just kind of take what I get, like Bruce's situation in the US. But if you're one of the top guys, you have a driver. And sometimes, you know, it's the photographer hiring the driver even. Mm. And you travel with that person and you work with that driver at every race. So in that case, yeah, you can develop a good relationship. But yeah, for me, it would be, I don't know if I've ever had the same driver twice, honestly. So I just have to kind of hope for the best. Yeah, you can get kind of a crazy or dangerous driver for sure.
I can imagine. Do you speak French, Ethan?
Not really.
So that's even an additional barrier to trying to figure things out.
Yeah, well, I haven't been on a moto here yet. So when I'm talking about my experiences on a moto, it's in the US.
Yeah, okay.
Or you know what I would be doing here if I were getting on a moto. It would be very difficult. I would have to, you know, if I were here and on a moto and the driver didn't speak English, it would just be, I mean, actually I've been in a car. At one race they gave me a car with a driver and he didn't speak English. That actually worked out really well. He said something to me at the beginning I didn't understand, and I nodded. And then he took me to, like, every amazing spot on the course, and we got there like 30 seconds before the race. So I hopped out of the car, got a bunch of great shots, hopped back in the car, and he got me to like a dozen spots. It was pretty incredible. It was on a course where I probably could have gotten myself to two or three spots.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That has nothing to do with motos, really. But
well, no, I think that's interesting. This reminds me of that the documentary series that we all binged at the beginning of the pandemic about the Tour of Flanders, right? The what was it called?
Oh,
was
yeah. I thought you were going to say the thing with the tigers.
Or the Last Dance.
I never watched that.
Don't bother.
The one that was about, that was like 4 years of behind the scenes footage of the Flanders races, Tour of Flanders. And it was really like told through like a ton of cameras. I mean, they must have had so much footage, but GoPros in the cars, GoPros on the motos. And you saw at one point you had one of the photographers lose his vest because they went through, couldn't quite understand. They went through a point they weren't supposed to go. They went past.
They went on the sidewalk.
Was that okay?
Yeah, they went on the sidewalk. I think it was like Tim DiVella and Bettini's son, not the older Bettini, but the younger one with the long hair.
Yeah, I mean, just trying to learn how to navigate that as a photographer, it was really eye opening. And I think I really enjoyed seeing all that, sort of like how the sausages are made. Especially, you know, coming from my background. So that was really interesting.
The thing that Ethan brought up that maybe should be mentioned, I mean, we're talking about motos, and he mentioned preferring to be in a car. And I kind of, sort of in a perfect world, do prefer the car over the moto, just because I can have a bag of all my stuff. And ultimately, I'm like Ethan in that I would prefer to get to a spot, get set up, get a shot, and get out of there. I also don't have the best. I don't think that anybody gets their best stuff from a moto. I mean, you're often getting some tight shots. You might be able to capture a key moment in the race because you are there constantly. If you really are just following the action, I just don't think those are the best shots. I mean, you can kind of get a nice like close up on the face or whatever, things like that. That can be really good. But I also prefer to, you know, drive someplace and set up. But some of the interesting differences with the car versus the moto, as far as like getting around the race, the moto is so much better because you can thread the needle, right? You can just get in and out of places very fast. So that's where it works well. Also, when you are weaving around and trying to get places, I actually feel safer on the moto. I don't know what it is, but when you're in a car and you are trying to speed, you know, to stay up with a race, and they're going through windy roads or trying to keep up on a downhill that's like 50 miles an hour, and we're just hauling through these corners, I feel more unsafe in a car. Like that car is going to flip than I would on a moto trying to chase a race.
I will say that I felt perfectly safe, and Bruce will get you where you need to be to get those shots in a race, no matter what, is my experience.
I feel like there's a good story there.
Not one I can tell.
Oh, okay.
No, we just did. You know, I mean, it was a closed course, so I'm sure some of the driving was probably within the bounds. But yeah, we've worked together where we have gotten ourselves around a course very quickly, very strategically, and pushed the limits of the car. But we made it work, and everybody's safe, and it's better than us being on motos all day.
I had a contract this year that got canceled that I was ready to hire Bruce just as a driver.
I might be better at driving than at cameras, so it's all right. I think I can take that off.
I'm looking at the UCI sent out a media advisory for the World Championships, and I think something that all of us near and dear to our heart is the how the UCI goes about allotting their race bibs and a who gets one, and then where you are in the hierarchy, yellow versus red. So check this out. World Championship, Road World Championship. So, you know, think about how many credentials we are dealing with for when we're covering World Cup and World Cyclocross, and just the number of photographers they allow for that. For the World Championships this year, 40 total bibs, 10 red and 30 yellow, and that's it.
Ouch.
So 10 guys allowed at the finish line at the World Championship.
I mean, I'd be happy, really, really happy if I was one of those 10.
You know what? Honestly, so this is maybe a weird take from a photographer. I'd almost prefer that if every race would just guarantee, 100% guarantee, that they're going to fire out a finish line shot that anybody can use for any purpose within 10 minutes of the finish, then it would free me up to not have to worry about maybe my client is going to win or whatever. And I would be happy to not be there shooting that finish shot. I could go, if it's on a road course, I could go to the last corner or some other, you know, some other critical spot that I would normally miss. Or at a cross race, I could go back and be among the soigneurs. You know, I think the biggest thing is, you know, I don't, for the red bib, at the, even at the cross races, I don't need that 90% of the time. It's just that 10% when it's critical, because it's the only way I can get that finish shot if it's a rider I need. I would almost prefer that all races could some, they could just somehow have a system where they guarantee, because, you know, most of them, the vast majority of races, they're going to send out a press release with a finish line shot, critical podium shots, and maybe one or two action within, say, an hour or two of the event. But it's not a guarantee. If it were a guarantee, then that would completely change how I think about those bibs and that kind of hierarchy.
Yeah, and it would take, you're right, it would take a lot of the pressure off. And, you know, we're like, Bruce and I are in D.C., and we have friends who are, you know, pool photographers for the White House, and it's basically, you know, one guy gets picked per trip, and they're basically, you know, for reporters too, they're covering the story for everyone else. So you don't have 100 different reporters there, and they could do the same thing. They could just have a pool photographer, take those finish, somebody who's competent, take those finish line shots. Everybody's getting the same shot. You know, I mean, you are fractions of a second off of somebody else, the person right next to you's shot. So it's pretty much the same. And then it allows, you know, just like we were dealing with in Switzerland for Cyclocross Worlds this year, where I was getting a little nervous because a couple of the riders who were clients had a chance of winning, and I, you know, wear the yellow bibs, which Ethan and I were given, were allowed to set up for the finish line. You had zero shot. I mean, you had UCI officials standing in front of you. You were, you know, super, like the worst just positioning, really far back, no riser, nothing. I mean, there was no shot. And Ethan and I actually ended up shooting from behind because it was the best look. And at least for me, you know, lucky or unlucky, the people who I was concerned about did not get on the podium. But I think that that's a worthwhile solution, and definitely one that's workable. You know, I mean, we all have our own workaround on that anyway. I think between the four of us, we've shared winner or podium shots when one of us missed it and was like, oh crap, I need that shot, and getting it from somebody else. So at least I think in our community, we have a good enough friendship, working relationship that it's not as big a deal. But yeah, I agree, Ethan. That would be a huge help to everyone.
Yeah, there is one wrinkle with that, which is that is commercial usage.
Right.
So if
right,
you had
right.
somebody who wanted to yeah. take out, you know, their rider wins and they want to make a full page ad for, you know, for a magazine, then, you know, who gets the, you know, that's, it's tough to lose out on that money.
Yeah. Yeah, true. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting thinking about, like, you know, some of the things maybe that come from COVID, the things that come from COVID, and even like the entire, this is like, it's not even photography or media, but like society based, these like changes we make, how many of those actually last after COVID? But the idea of a pool photographer is interesting for the finish line. And I was thinking about USA Crits, you know, they have their staff photographer, and I think what they do, you know, they have an interesting setup with, you know, you use a team, you buy into the series. But I think what that means is that gives team access to all the photos that their, you know, photographer shoots, which is interesting. It's great. It's a great deal for the teams, although it doesn't mean, like, it's not guaranteed your guy's going to get a photo. But this guy's there for 8 races, shooting all the races. You're eventually, your team's going to get covered. It is an interesting, like, as the, from a race promoter's perspective, giving out those photos.
I hate that. It's horrible. I mean, it's the kind of thing going to, you know, and I did for the mountain bike stuff that I was doing last year, you know, even though I had my main client every time, you know, picking up extra money from other riders out there who wanted photo coverage was kind of how I made ends meet. And if the promoter, and it happened with Epic Rides, is shooting everyone and giving away the photos for free, it's basically just taking money out of your pocket.
Bill, you brought up the World Championships in Switzerland, the number of vests, you know. I was also reading through some of the regulations, and it was like, you're wearing a mask at all times. Fair, totally fair. That's what we do. The other thing was the socially distanced media room. And all I could think about was the media room at Trek, where it's like anything but, and you're put in there like a sardine can, literally a pit of media bodies. And, I mean, I guess if you have the space to do that, I mean, it makes sense.
To me, that's hardly even just go work in your car or go back to the hotel, or I don't know. I don't see that as a big issue at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what most of us really care about in that situation is somewhere to stow our stuff. You know, at least for me,
true.
If I just have some place that I can dump everything for the day, then that's really a
good point.
But you also need internet, Wi-Fi. Got to deliver those photos to the clients.
But you can always buy your own.
My suggestion to these promoters would be set up something outside, you know, that, if there's anything we do know on COVID, it's that it's being inside that is more of an issue than being outside, right? So eliminate that part of it. Get hotspots or something that's outside for people who really need it. Anyone who can work in their car, you should work in your car. Maybe they have a place where you have like a bag check. You know, you can go and stow, because stowing your stuff is important. So maybe those are some things that you do. But personally, I wouldn't want to be in a media room. And honestly, even if 6 feet apart, I would not be all that interested in. We can sit in that room for hours. So someone's sick, that just sort of circulating through that room for hours. And to me, that's the same or maybe even worse than the risks of going to, you know, a restaurant or someplace like that, or a bar, maybe. I don't know. Sometimes it's like a bar in the media room a little bit. Depends on who's
Yeah, when Bill comes back with all the beers from the vendors.
So what you're saying, Bruce, is that Tacoma Nationals was ahead of their time.
I'd be okay with that. That would be a great setup. I'd be fine with that, except maybe, you know, no sides on the tents, and let's just let the air flow. And yeah,
maybe since it rained nonstop, maybe a floor.
I think I would have preferred a floor. We could have taken those sides and just made them the floor, and I would have been happy. I shouldn't say I wasn't happy.
For those that don't know, the media center at Tacoma was a tent outside, and it especially with the wind, it got a little dicey there at times.
I was at Tour of Alberta one year, and one of the media rooms was like a cow pen that they had moved the cows out of like an hour earlier.
Awesome.
Amazing. Well, that does keep you from hanging around too long.
But they didn't move the flies out.
Yeah. Well, I remember Austin CX Nationals was in the media pit also outside in the tent when it was like...
And nobody went in that. It was like, I went by there and whoever was the press person for USA Cycling at that time was so happy that somebody had actually stopped by because it was awful.
Yeah.
I don't even remember it. Did we stop by there?
It was near the finish line, like halfway down the finishing stretch.
Right.
Impossible to get to. And you looked at it and they had these clear walls that were just like, just dripping, just steamed up and dripping. It just looked miserable.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if it was either a steam bath in there or it was freezing or it was something about the conditions in there also. I was like, I can't hang
Other reason we never really spent time in there is because none of us were there on Monday when the races happened.
Oh, yeah, actually, that was part of the point, too. Plus, we got to go back to the house we were staying at and hang by the pool, which was...
The ranch.
Which was nice. At the ranch that we stayed at. That was pretty great.
The complex. It was amazing.
It was definitely complex.
If you saw the Airbnb photos of this place, it looked amazing. Like, we were going to be party central.
Yeah.
Except that it was, like, raining inside, and every fraternity party that had been there before us had completely trashed the place. The pool was just like leaking and cracked everywhere. It was something to behold.
It was like a compound, I would say. Yeah. It's more than a complex. It was like, and each had their own character to it. That's for sure. And level of dilaptitude.
Bruce, however, did because Bruce's gig is I'm going to get sick before every national championship, so he did score.
Oh, yeah.
He did score the best place in that compound. He had his own little apartment.
Thank you. I did. That's true. I think I still got sick.
So I can see why you're especially concerned about coronavirus now. I mean, if you are prone to catching something,
yeah, you're the super spreader.
Only around championships, though. Only around championships. Only around championships. So. Yeah.
By the way, I did want to just tack on one other thought about the media room thing, which is that, you know, from Bruce and my perspective, you know, we're not typically on a really tight deadline. Maybe if a client wins a race, we want to get them a shot as quickly as possible. But there are, you know, at these bigger races, there are... people working for large publications, people working for wire services, and they're going to obviously... I mean, some of them want cabled... You know, they want an Ethernet cable. They won't even work on the Wi-Fi. So that's a whole different... a whole different thing. But, you know, if you just had those people in the room, then that would just be a handful of people.
Agreed. And I still think you could supply that outside.
Yeah, it's very possible.
We talked about this in the last media pit. There still are a few UCI races on the calendar in the States, cross races. I mean, Bruce, Bill, that you guys are here. Would you go to any of those if they end up happening? I mean, do you think it would be even not? I don't know. I guess the question is like, if a client asks, or even if not, like, is there any, do you have any sort of interest or like curiosity, like wanting to be there to cover that event? And is that even the right thing to do?
I don't think I'm traveling to any races this year, even if they exist.
Yeah,
I don't anticipate that I'll go. I haven't really decided on this. I know that I can, I've really thought through the process, and certain types of events, certain types of situations, especially if there are no spectators. Like, I think it can be done safely. I think that you can stay distant. I would feel more concerned for the racers than for myself. Like, I can just, if spectators are not allowed or it's really low, I can just be on the 7200, maybe a 300. I can be very distant, get everything I need. So it can be done. I think it can be done safely.
Oh, you get your hugs.
Without you in these states, I don't get a lot of hugs, Ethan. So
I don't even look at it from, safety is obviously the biggest issue. I think there's more of a, just kind of taking a stand on the season aspect mm-hmm. of it. Is it fair at this point to go to a UCI event that happens if we're starting the season in November? I just think it's, I don't know. I'm not 100% against it, but I'd say I'm right now at about 90-95%. I don't, we've canceled 3/4 of the season already. I just don't see the point of running off to these few races that are still on the schedule, and I'm not sure who's racing at them either. And that's the thing. I mean, what kind of fields are you getting? And then again, it's like, are you going to be, is it almost like not supporting the people that made the decision not to race and have already hung up for their season for the few people that do? There's a lot to consider that I really haven't done the math on yet. But right now I can definitely would be leaning towards probably not going. I mean, if I had to do work, I may even contract it out. I don't know.
Well, and I don't disagree with you on that. I'm basically in the same place as you are. I was sort of playing devil's advocate a little bit, I guess, there. I'm basically saying, can it be done? I think it can be done.
Yes.
Safely. Should it be done?
Right.
Is a whole other question.
Yeah. That's kind of where I'm at. I'm with you on that. And the same with nationals. I mean, we talk about it a lot, but I don't see it happening, and I'm just not sure what it looks like or if it's something that is going to be fun to go to or worth supporting if it does.
Meanwhile, Ethan is just going to, be busy all summer and winter.
No, I've
did you see the thing where it said that in Belgium the sports had to take part behind closed doors? Have you?
I'm not up on the latest Belgian regulations. I did see that in the Netherlands, I think some smaller races recently got canceled at the last minute because they couldn't guarantee that the crowds would be socially distant.
Yeah.
I mean, if that kind of a standard starts to get applied to other road races, a lot more road races will get canceled. But everything here is country by country. So,
right.
So the Netherlands could have very strict standards compared with Belgium. I suspect Belgium's standards for bike races will be a little looser than other countries. Just speculating. But as far as cyclocross, I don't see how you can have a cross race with a crowd. I just don't see how you can do it here. I mean, the way they pack people in like sardines, it's just not. Right. It's just not feasible.
Yeah, that was my thought too. And also, it's we talked about it on our last episode, but just that the economics about how a lot of those races work, it's really ticket sales that drive them. So I don't see the incentive for a lot of organizers to even have their races if they can't have DJ Benny there and pack the dance tent.
Yeah, you have to be something that's very. I'm sure there's a handful of races on the calendar that get big TV audiences, and those might go forward.
You figure they would subsidize the World Cup somehow to make them happen.
Yeah, though some of the World Cups have already dropped off, including World Cups in Belgium.
Yeah, yeah.
So, although I think, I was looking at the calendar before we started, and it's just strange how some of the, like in France, for example, I think there's 2 or 3 UCI races that have canceled, cross races. And one of them was in like February. And I was thinking, why would you cancel that now? And I think a lot of the cancellations are, these people, it's the economics of it. They're probably right on the edge, whether they're going to make money or not anyway. And they figure, look, if this is potentially a loss for us, why don't we just shut it down now?
It brings up the question about the U.S. economics compared to the European economics, where so much of it is about registrations and all that, which I don't know how any of these UCI, I don't know how they do that. I mean, if in theory, if you got enough registrations throughout the day and you did have races with the amateurs and they made some money, I mean, you could kind of shoo people out of there, I guess, and have no spectators for the pro race in the U.S. You know what I mean? You could probably, I guess my point is that in the U.S., the spectator issue is clearly not as dire as it would be in Europe.
Yeah, well, I've been at a number of races in the U.S. where you know pretty big name riders in the elite races, and you know so many people have packed up and gone home because they've already raced earlier. They're exhausted. You know, it's like the sun is setting. They've got things to do. They got to go home and make dinner, whatever it is. And then you get some great duel between like Hyde and Powers, and there's hardly anybody there. I mean, it's a shame, but yeah, I don't think you'd be, you know, it wouldn't be like the Japanese subway where you have to have like people with like brooms like pushing everybody out of the venue. You know, it might be just a matter of like grabbing that one last straggler person and asking them to leave. There probably will be a bunch of cross races that'll happen, you know, possibly without spectators in Belgium. And I was thinking, you know, is it worth it for me to go or not? And probably what I'll end up doing is, I don't think I'll go to any races unless Americans somehow make it over and show up and I can actually get a little bit of work. And then if there's not crowds or if there's somehow greatly reduced crowds, I would feel okay about going and shooting some of those races. But I don't think if Americans don't show up or if I don't have clients from other, you know, all the Belgian riders are all tied up. If I don't have clients from other countries, I don't think it's going to be worth it for me to, you know, to rent a car and travel up there on the weekends. So I'm probably out for the season as well, unless people can get visas somehow and get over here.
I have a question for you all. Just straight, working as a photographer, and is there one photo that you still think about that you missed that bugs you to this day?
Can I go first? Sort of.
Yeah.
It's not like a shot that I missed because I got back and I was like, oh, it's out of focus. That'd be the most amazing shot ever. But it's more a situation. So, in 2013 in Louisville, Julian Alaphilippe was there with the French team. And I only have one photo of him and his head is cut off. I always think, man, if I had a good photo of him from Louisville, I could use that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, just on social media or whatever, just to be like,
yep.
Like, you know, when he wins a race, I could be like, hey, remember when he was in Louisville?
Yeah. That's exactly the situation I'm thinking about. Michael, Bruce, anything come to mind?
Well, I guess I don't dwell a lot on those, but I would agree that it's something, I guess it's a missed shot in that I do think about, oh, I didn't even know so-and-so was here, or, oh, if I wish I had known, I would have been over in that location, but I can't really regret those things. One thing I do remember, and maybe it's because it was so many years ago and each shot was so much more precious to me, I guess, in a way, because that's where I was in my career and my thinking. But I was covering Race Across America, and yeah, there was a team I was following, and we went by the spot where we were coming right by the rider, and there was this perfect double rainbow in the background, and I just didn't quite have the right camera with me, and it would have been, it seems silly, but at that time, that just ate me up for like days. That was about 5 days we followed that race. And I couldn't let that one go. I've since let that go. But that was a thing where it's like, you know, I just didn't have the right lens, the right camera, the right thing right in front of me. That is super frustrating to me when I don't have the tools ready to go. That's when I get frustrated about missing a shot, because especially, and this is maybe something you guys can relate to, I was shooting a little bit of video on that event too. And if you've got one camera, I think that might've actually been the situation. I had one camera set up for video, one for photo, and then I couldn't grab the video one. So I had to use the photo one and it wasn't ready to go, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe you video guys do more video can talk about that.
No, that always stinks. Trying to do both is horrible. Michael, anything come to mind?
Well, first, yeah, you can't do both on the same camera. I've tried that. It's especially if it's if it's like an actual photo camera. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously you can't shoot photos on a video camera, but just the settings you need to adjust. I can't think of a specific photo, but I have most definitely been in countless situations where I'm like, oh God, that's an amazing moment. And then you pull the camera up and it's gone.
Yeah.
Or like you said, Bruce, you just don't have the right lens or the tool for it. You know, I feel like it's to me, it's always some sort of silhouette shot where someone perfectly walks into a framed spot and I'm just like, oh, and then you try and recreate it and you miss it. But yeah. And also there are tons of shots that I've missed. You get back and the focus is just off. And I think I've probably had at least 50 photos that I just are great, but they're out of focus and I can't use them.
Yeah. It's like on the way to a race and it's still like, it was probably 4 a.m. and was driving by one of those big construction signs and it was supposed to say sobriety check ahead. And instead it said sorority check ahead. And it was just like this Freudian typo that I'm like, why didn't I stop and take a picture of this?
Oh man.
And then
it's always that thing where you have to convince yourself not to stop, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just, yeah, no. And then it was like miles away. I was like, crap, I should have done it. And then the second one, Ethan, actually happened with you that I think about. And it was probably because I was like deathly ill at the time and just wanted to get the hell out of there. But when we were walking out of Worlds, and Vanderpool and his whole posse is like walking towards us and it's kind of like backlit with those lights and there's like water coming off of the asphalt reflection and everything. And they are just like this gang. And there's nobody. It's just basically me and Ethan. They're all walking to the press conference. We kind of like snuck out there early and, you know, he waves, says hi, you know, everything. I'm like, that's the kind of one I was like, even with my phone, I was like, it would have been cheesy just to like run in front of and take this shot. But at the same time, like it could have been a pretty cool shot.
Yeah. That would have been a good one.
I don't know if this goes to the point of like missing a shot. It really doesn't go to regretting missing a shot. But I'm wondering how you guys feel about it when you, especially in a cross race where it's a small venue, we're all working the venue, you know, 3K or whatever course, we're all getting different shots of the same thing. And I do really enjoy seeing how other people approach the same scene that I do. And maybe they got it from a different angle. And I don't see it from a regret standpoint at all. I just go, oh, that was really smart. Like that. And I try to process it and learn from it and say, you know, I really need to think more about shooting from this side or shoot low here or shoot high or whatever. So I guess it doesn't necessarily go to like missed shot, but I do look at that like, oh, that was smart. You know, I like my shot, but man, I wish that I had thought to go a little bit more over here. I don't know. Do you guys look at other people's work? Think about that?
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the more fun things that comes out of those weekends is it's a challenge, right? It's a unique challenge. It's trying to solve a problem. And they're like, yeah, like Bruce, you will think you've solved it in a unique way. And then someone will show their photo and you're like, oh, wow. And then it's like, damn, okay. Like it's inspiring. And it's like now it kind of ups the game a bit, I feel like. Like everybody is pushing each other to sort of work the angles a little better. So yeah, I actually really enjoy that. And there is, you do kind of sometimes when you see a really good one, you're like, oh, damn. Like, that's way better. All right. Like, how can I? And then also sometimes maybe you like, I don't know. I've seen angles and I'm like, next year. I know where to go. I won't do it this year, but, you know, I'll wait till next year.
You know, speaking of that, does anybody ever take notes like that? I've thought about doing that and I never have. Does anybody ever sit down and write a diary out or take notes about what you did wrong or right at a race?
I have a feeling we all do mentally. So, and here's my question.
No, but I always forget by the time the next year rolls around.
I'll go back and look at my photos from a previous, if I shot it the year before, back and look at it, see what worked, see what didn't work, probably focus more on what didn't work. And that, yeah, I might not have taken an actual note, but generally I'll remember like, oh yeah, everybody else or somebody else was shooting up. I know they were up from a different angle. Or I knew that something was a little off about it. And then I'll remember when I go do my scouting before the event and I'll find it. And, but yeah, I do it by reviewing what I shot the year
before. So here's my question kind of based on that. Cause what I really noticed coming into mountain biking in Europe is that, especially with the downhill photographers, but then it kind of ported over to the cross country photographers as well. And I know you guys have seen this, and I think Sven Martin probably is the guy who's maybe responsible for a lot of this. There's definitely like a school of shooting for those races. There is a look. You look at what they're doing at these races, the angles that they're getting, a lot of foreground, you know, stuff in there. And it's sort of gone from photographer to photographer that they're all kind of getting that same look. And then you come in there, me not knowing what I'm doing, and I'm just getting different looks, good or bad. It doesn't look the same as what everybody else is doing. That, do you think at this point, especially with like US photographers that cover cyclocross, do you think that we have a look? Do you think that when other photographers come in here that you're seeing something different, or do you think that everybody's still bringing their own kind of style and perspective into it?
I would say I see more of that in Europe, actually, especially in the road scene. I think there's definitely a look that dominates. With cyclocross, especially over here, there's only certain places you can shoot. And so you can't be nearly as creative as you can in the US. So people end up with the same shots, but they're not, I wouldn't say it's the same look. They're just the same because everybody's got to be in the same spot. It's like the finish line shot, but dotted around the course 10 times.
I would disagree a little bit about that, just with the races that I was at this year. And you noticed it as well, is that you get that same cadre of Belgian shooters who all hang out together, who all long lens it from the same spots. And I think do have the same look. And if you actually, you know, that's why I was looking. I was like, is there something wrong with the rest of this course or what's going on? But I think they just know, and they're sort of locked into the shots they know are going to work. And that's where they are at each time. And they're all in the same place.
I understand what you're saying, but a lot of those guys are shooting for publications that need the shots really quick. They're shooting in a style that I would call like a really straightforward documentary style.
Yeah.
Like a wire shooter.
Yeah.
So even though they all have the same look, I don't think they're sort of creatively going for that look.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, whereas on the road, I think people are making creative choices, especially in post-processing, that end up giving them the same look. So I completely understand what you're saying. I would just maybe make that distinction.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, for sure. Because there are a lot of those guys are just sending them out from the field too. And they're just going wire. They're just straight up. They're not even editing.
Right. Yeah. I know we're thinking of the same people, and I've seen them sending shots from their, you know, between laps, they're sending shots from their phone.
Yeah.
So
I won't name any names, but we've seen some examples of guys who come over to the US to shoot, and they shoot in different ways. They for sure shoot in different ways. I mean, there's one photographer I can think of who I find him to be, he can be straight up very editorial, but also turns out some pretty beautiful creative work. I think it's sort of B-roll for him. I think he just does it because he wants to do that. But I think it's, I think there can be some variation there. Yeah. Does that help without me telling you any names?
So I guess okay. So you guys don't think that there's an American look out there.
I don't think there's an American look at all. I think, I don't know. I should say at all. I think that what Ethan brought up, the fact that it's not so same. Our style is that we don't, like, I don't know. Does this count as a style? We're not so pigeonholed, I think, here. I think people feel a little freer to do a variety of things. Just like Ethan said, I don't know that we have a style. I think we shoot maybe a little bit more, a little bigger, at times, more scene, showing the scene. I know we've heard a lot with people and you know, shooting in Belgium and other places, they really want to get tight on the rider. Whereas here in the US, we'll show a big wider scene more often. I think that a lot of the shooters who we work around have a different approach, and they stay fairly true to their approach. So like I said earlier about, you know, oh, that was a good idea to go over and be at this angle. That isn't me saying, oh, I want to get that exact shot that rider or that shooter got. That just means I want to take it from a different angle, and I will hopefully get it in a unique way that will sort of hold true to who I am. And I think we all do that. I think that perhaps that is part of the nature of shooting a cyclocross race. We're dealing with, as I said, it's a limited venue, 3K or whatever it is. And we're all trying to carve out our own little niche in there. I mean, why would we all just sit there and try and shoot the exact same thing? What's the point of that? So I think we want to have something unique. I would hope we do. I would hope we weren't all trying to be like each other.
Do you think there's any competition amongst the photographers to find that? I mean, is there an Instagram competition going on?
Yes. I think, of course. I think so. I mean,
it's a friendly competition.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that one, to address your kind of first question, I think at least in the American photographers, I think everybody has a style that at this point I can recognize without maybe seeing the handle. You could show me the photo and I could tell you, especially with the editing processes, looks that people use. And, you know, as someone who is more new to cycling photography, all three of you are photographers that I've looked up to and sort of looked at how you've shot and how you've covered races and to learn the process and try to see like, okay, they were here then, there then. That gives me an idea of like where I need to be. Like, how do you tell the story, right? I'm always thinking about the story. So, and I think that's cool. And yeah, I think there is, like I said earlier, I think there is a unique challenge, and that is part of the fun, is solving the puzzle. Right. And Bruce, yeah, we are restricted and, sometimes restrictions kind of like produce better work. Right. So it is something I really, like I said, last episode, we were coming up on almost September. Like I've missed this community coming together and us doing this work together. And, you know, I guess maybe a year off from shooting will mean that I'll get so much recovery and I'll just come out next season just with super, like a super high TSS score of photography or something. I don't know.
I've heard that's a thing.
I do agree with that. I mean, one of the nice things I like about our scene is that I feel that generally we all get along pretty well in cyclocross among the people who cover the big races. I think we all get along, and is there some competition? Of course, on some level, but it's all pretty friendly. And, you know, I find that we will, if we see someone else doing good work, we'll come up and let them know that and tell them that and say, hey, you really killed it on that last race or whatever it is, or this one shot you got, man, that was the shot of the day. And I, you know, wasn't my shot, but I have no problem letting somebody else know that they got that shot. Like, I think we all kind of support each other in that way. And you know, we have to have a nice working environment. We're not, you know, we're on top of each other a lot and around each other a lot, and we have to be respectful. And I think we all have a really nice community of people in general, at least in the US. I would say that. I don't know, Ethan may have his own take on working in Europe.
I think it's a good community in Europe as well. It's a much larger community, so people are kind of, you get clicks, which is fine. Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot more photographers at a race, so people are going to gravitate towards, you know, their group. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think there's a good camaraderie. I will say, I don't, this is not really related to getting along at a race or whatever, but last year I was at a road race and I needed some shots of a team I was shooting for, and I missed something. And I sent a message to a guy that we all know. I mean, we're not like super, it's, you know, one of the Belgians who comes over. to the US for cross. And I said, hey, do you know anybody else who was at this race who can help me fill out this gallery? And within like an hour, somebody sent me a folder of like 100 shots.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was like, man, how can I pay you back? And he's like, I know you're going to be at races. You know, you can help me out sometime in the future. Like, it's just like it would be with us. So.
Yeah. I found the same thing when I was over there. I mean, especially navigating these smaller races where I didn't know how to get around and nobody spoke English and there's no signage where, you know, those guys were super help. At one point, I got the wrong credential, and since they're so well known, they don't even need, you know, they got their vests, their permanent vests and everything. He just gave me his credentials. He said, here, don't even worry about it. Just go. And I was like, great, thanks. So yeah, I feel like that same camaraderie, at least in the cyclocross shooters, exists. And it was actually really nice to see, because you get this, you sort of feel like they have the reputation of not being that way, but it was pretty nice and pretty good, to easy to get around. And once, after I was at three or four races, it was just, you know, you're kind of a known entity in there. Tall American guy.
You were probably one of the first photographers that, I mean, I met you before, but sort of, I think it was a Derby Cup 2017. You came up to me and said, hey, that was an amazing shot. Shot of the day. And that set an example for me, like, oh, okay. So like it's not like we are competitive, but we are friendly. And what it did is I was like, oh, well then that's great. Like that made me feel good. And I started like wanting to make sure that if I saw a photo someone else did, I wanted to compliment them on it, because you had sort of set that example to me. And I think that was like really cool. And I've come from, you know, documentary background, and sometimes things can get competitive if it's a big event that you're filming and you're trying, like maybe there is somebody that you're interested in telling their story and there's someone else who also wants to tell that story. And there is sort of like a desire to be the only person telling that story. So you do kind of like put up walls and are very defensive. And so just to have you say that to me at the venue sort of changed my perspective. And I think that was a good move, and that helps to build that community. And so I always remember that moment, and I thought it was pretty awesome.
That's awesome. That's great. Well, thanks. I can't say where I got it from, but I feel like I'm just kind of carrying that on and just doing what I would do. And somebody had done that for me, and I see other people do. I'm not the only one who does it.
Yeah.
But I think we need to, as photographers, keep that going, and don't sort of poison the well. Like, let's keep that going. I do enjoy that when I go through some of the social media, and I do find that, you know, one of our colleagues will put something up, and then three other photographers will be like, oh, that's great. Great shot. Great work. And we see that all the time. And it's not just like, you know, you don't get a sense that there's a bunch of, you know, there's 12 other photographers behind their screens stewing about this photo they didn't get. <You know? laughs> It's all good.
Let's move on to some tech talk to finish this off. Michael, I know you got some questions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we just had some, this has been a good year for camera releases, and I'm looking for another camera to sort of fill out my fleet. So I do documentary film work. My production company, small production company, owns a Panasonic EVA One, great camera. It's fantastic. And then I've got, you know, for photo work, I've got my 5D Mark III, which I've had for almost 8 years now and does amazing photos. And, you know, but it would be nice to have another camera, two bodies at a bike race shooting photos, or filming a video interview and like having an A camera and a B camera so I can cut, because I can cut the interview without going to B-roll. And so like I've gone from the Panasonic S1H, which came out, which is an awesome camera, would cut together well with my EVA One. And then, you know, Canon released the R5 mirrorless. Canon's, was that the first mirrorless or their second mirrorless?
Oh, they've had several goes at this, but this is really their first sort of, I guess, pro level. Yeah.
Yeah. It really like, I mean, it shoots 8K video, which is ridiculous. No one needs 8K RAW. But like, they really put in all the features. And I was like, great. Now that's the camera to get. But then you learn that it overheats if you shoot at 4K. And then Bill's our Sony man. You know, Sony releases the A7 SRX.
S3.
I can't even.
A7 S3.
their names. And so this, like, I watch the videos and, like, it checks all the boxes. It's an amazing video camera, but, like, it doesn't shoot stills very well. And so I'm like, I would love a camera that could be a second body if I'm taking photos at a bike race and also shoot video as a second, like, angle. And I, and like, there's none of, like, all of those cameras sort of, like, are good in one area and not good in the other area. And I'm like trying to decide, like, what do I do? Like,
I mean, for you,
go in all,
for you personally, I mean, you're already invested in Canon glass and you're not bringing your bigger, you know, video cameras to races with you. That's not the work that you're doing there. So I don't see why you wouldn't just get that Canon.
Yeah, it does shoot. I mean, it's fit, like, the stills, it's an amazing still cameras. Like, and we mentioned this earlier, like the autofocus.
Yeah.
Like,
and the Sony, actually, Bruce was like, yeah, you've looked at those specs, right? I'm like, oh yeah, it's just like the S2. It's a shitty stills camera.
Yeah.
Wait, what's bad about the Sony on the still side?
It's like 12 megapixels, and it's, I mean,
well, main body is 12 megapixels. I still shoot with it.
Yeah, in situ, I think it's fine. It gets you by. But it's like, I mean, my less expensive, you know, A7 III is like 21 megapixels.
You know, right. I mean, as far as megapixel stuff, man, I've 99% of the shots that I send out, people tell me to crop it to 2,000 pixels on the long end. So I could shoot it with like a 4-megapixel camera if I didn't crop.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, look, sometimes you can pixel peep too much, right? There is a dive into the specs too much. I guess, you know, as I said, maybe in the Slack, I'm trying to figure out what works in my workflow. And also, there's just a lot of these cameras are all, like, I want to buy all of them. Like, I want to have them all. Yeah. I want to have all the toys.
I will say that the overheating part is kind of, I'm just not putting too much stock in it. Because now people, of course, everybody's like, because the Sony supposedly didn't overheat. And now everybody's like, oh, no. If you put it on high temperature and you put, you know, setting and you put it in the direct sunlight, after 45 minutes, it will overheat at, you know, 4K, 120 frames per second. I'm like, who is doing that for that long? I mean, that you're looking at natively, you're looking at 2 hours of footage, you know, if you're slowing it down to 120 frames per second. I'm like, you're never doing that. What's the real world situation for that? And they're like, well, I, you know, I'm filming my church service and I need it to go for the whole time. It's like, well, why are you doing that in 4K? I don't get that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, sometimes it's not so much the tools as the story, but...
Yeah, but if that's the case, then yes, that's not the camera for you. If that's what you need it for, then you need to look elsewhere. But for everything else that both of these, like the Canon and that Sony body have to offer, I don't think you could really go wrong on either.
I mean, Canon, stick with Canon. I got Canon glass.
Right.
So the thing is, I have to learn how to match Canon RAW video, Canon S-Log to Sony V-Log in post, which I can, you know, that's the thing. Like, if you're mixing video, it's like, how are you, you got to make sure you can match it when you color grade it.
Well, that's the one thing with the new Sony is that their color science, I mean, I will 100% agree to that. Like, the color science of Sony, especially like on those earlier A7 bodies, is not good. And it's very pink and magenta-y, especially in the shadows and stuff. And it's something that always kind of bugged me. But supposedly, like, this new one will match better with the Canon because it's just a more neutral, everything's coming out the way it's supposed to look, especially in log. And you can shoot in log because it's 10-bit versus 8-bit.
Right. Yeah, it's that Sony really has a beefy codec. Matches what my Panasonic EVA does. So... yeah, I mean, I guess it's good we don't have races coming up, or otherwise I would be buying some new gear. Bill, you ordered a Sony?
I did. I've been waiting for 5 years. I had to order it.
Bruce, did you order the new 1DX?
1DX? I already have two Mark IIs. They're fine. I don't need the Mark III. I mean, it does have a nice autofocus system and a little better on ISO. I mean, I would like to have that, but no, I'm not dropping 6K at the moment.
Yeah.
Currently don't need another camera body. Like, I mean, I don't really need one. I could probably go a few years and not need another camera body. I'm fine. I mean, the form factor, it's a little heavier, all these things. It would be nice. You know, there's some advancements that I really appreciate, like higher ISO, like cleaner at high ISO. That's great because we want to shoot at high speeds, and sometimes it can be in darker conditions, especially if you're shooting like mountain bikes and stuff like that. And you got to be in the woods. Man, it's nice to be able to shoot high ISO and have it be a clean image. So those are good things. Autofocus keeps getting better. Like, that's huge. And so those are advancements that I like. But for the most part, I don't know. I feel like, well, no, Ethan's here, so maybe I'm not the Luddite on the panel right now. But for the most part, I mean, my cameras are, you know, technically, I don't remember when the Mark II came out. What was that, three or 4 years ago, maybe? 3 years ago? And I've got a couple of those. But I still shoot, you mentioned that 5D Mark III. I still use that camera. That is my favorite camera I've ever owned, just because I don't think it was meant to do what I do with it. But I've got over 1 million clicks on that camera, and it's a champ.
How do you find out your clicks?
Well, there's different like click counters that you can use. Mine came when I sent it to Canon, and they just let me know. I mean, when I had to replace, I've replaced one shutter, and I can't remember what it was. I think those shutters are rated at like 150 or no more than 250, 150,000 clicks. And I sent it in, and I was having a couple issues, and they're like, you know, you're at 650 on this camera. You probably want to go ahead and replace that shutter and mirror box. So I did. And I'm over 1 million, so I'm over 500, another 500,000 clicks on this new shutter, and the thing's a champ. I don't know. I must have gotten a good copy. Meanwhile, one of my 1DX Mark IIs has just, you know, I had to put that into the shop, like, right at about 100 or 200,000.
Do you get little medallions to put on your grill when you, like, pass these?
Or they get bought by Subaru. I'll have that.
That would be amazing.
I would definitely buy Subaru cameras. I'm all in on that. To buy the Subaru camera.
Ethan, wasn't your body like dying on you, or weren't you looking for a new camera?
I'm kind of looking for a new camera. Yeah.
But you should get the Canon, man.
No, if I'm going to get it, so I'll probably get the new Nikon mirrorless. Actually, will be my next body. So they have two out that are pretty good right now. This is Z6 and Z7. Z7 is kind of a higher megapixel one. It's like 45 by Bruce's standards. That's probably not very high. But then the Z6 is the 24 megapixel, and that's kind of it's a little faster, higher frame rate and stuff. So it's a little better for sports. It has some drawbacks. So in the fall, they're supposed to release updates to both of those. So it'll be like the Z6S or something. And when that comes out, I'll almost certainly buy one. So, I mean, it uses all the, you know, you can get an adapter. It uses all my F-mount glass, which is terrific. And it kind of varies by lens, but the lenses that I have supposedly work very well on the adapter. And almost, I would say as a sports shooter, I will probably notice a little bit of a difference in a lag, but supposedly it's not terrible.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say those 45 megapixel cameras, I mean, where you're getting up to like medium format for a sports shooter just seem ridiculous and seem like you're just going to be like, the file sizes are enormous.
I hate those large files, and I don't even like the file. I have a D500 that it's 20.9 megapixels or something. I think those files are too big.
No, and it's true. You think about how many files you have to download quickly after an event, and all of a sudden you're downloading you know, 264 gig cards or something like that. And I know video guys are like, whatever, you know, cry me a river. But, you know, for photographers, at least, I don't want to have to download that much stuff and then have to go through that. I mean, there's quite often at least one shot that I want to get out quickly. And so I'm basically going to have to just know what that shot is, probably go through the card, pick out that sequence, download that, get it out, and then go back and download the whole card, because it's just, it's going to take a while to get all that info transferred. And it just slows down the whole process to have that much.
Do you guys shoot JPEGs as well at the same time?
I was just going to say, actually, the bigger files, which, I mean, most people probably not think that a 21 megapixel file is big, but I think they're big and slow. So that changed the way I shoot. I now either do what Bruce just said. Sometimes I'll create a JPEG in camera and just export that, or I'll shoot both. I'll shoot raw and I'll shoot a bunch of small JPEGs, and then I'll just download the JPEGs first and just get the stuff out that has to get out immediately. Do, you know, minimal processing on it. And then I have all those raw files, but I don't, you know, I'll deal with those when I get home or something.
Yeah, 90% of what you see from me is JPEG. And a lot of that is just because of speed. I feel like if you know how to dial in your settings, you know how to read the scene, you can pretty much get it right. Raw, for me, quite often ends up being like, oh, I need to do some surgery on this file to make it work. Or it's there if you need it because somebody just needs something for an ad or whatever. I mean, the ideal scenario really is to be able to shoot JPEG and RAW at the same time, have both of those files available as long as your camera can roll them off quick enough and record them quick enough. Like, that's the ideal way to do it. And then for what we do, my take would be download all the JPEGs, work from the JPEGs, and then grab the RAW when you need it.
That's, I have to say, the new camera, I mean, and my D500 is hardly new. It's probably like 5 years old or something at this point. But the JPEGs that come out of that thing, sometimes I'll have, you know, I'll have both imported into Lightroom, and I'll think I'm working on the RAW and I'm working on the JPEG.
Yep.
And I'll get so much out of the sky, I'll get so much out of the shadows that I think it's a RAW file. And then I look at it and I'm like, why can't I zoom in on this? And then I realize it's because it's just a small JPEG. I'm like, how can there be so much information in it? And then the other thing about the JPEGs is sometimes when I'm shooting in the dark, like Bruce was talking about how we have to shoot in dark conditions a lot, sometimes I'll look at the JPEGs and it'll be like ISO, whatever, 16,000 or something. And the color is perfect and it's so clean. Even with the raw file, I hate to admit it, it makes me sound like a terrible post-processor. I don't know if I could get to that level of, you know, balancing the sharpness and the noise that comes out of these, you know, at the lower ISOs, I have an easier time. Like if it's an ISO 800 shot or something and I see some noise, I can usually deal with it better than what the JPEG is going to look like. But when it gets up into the really high ISOs, I don't know what the difference is, but for some reason, the way it's, you know, it's because, I mean, it's Nikon's files that they're making. So obviously the software that they make to deal with that is going to be the best. And so the JPEG files that come out, I find are pretty incredible.
That's interesting. I read something about, I was an NFL photographer and he's like, I only shoot JPEGs. Like, it's just the workflow. Also, he's like, also because if you're sending photos, you know, on the wire, or like, this is like a news for journalistic purposes, like, you're not going to really do much post-processing. In fact, some agencies don't even take, like, they only take JPEGs. Like, you can't process the photo, right? Because it's news. And so just working in JPEGs is a much more efficient.
Oh, yeah. And the people that we're shooting now for, mainly, especially when you're getting out quick, it's like my biggest, I limit all my files to 1.5 megabytes in my galleries that I send out to race clients. And then, just like Ethan was saying, and Bruce, if it comes back and they're like, oh, we want to, you know, do this in an ad or do this for whatever, then I'll go back and send a, you know, work on the RAW, or at least send a TIFF that's going to be much larger. But just the way they use those photos now, it's all social media, it's all just getting stuff out quick, and they don't want big files.
I mean, I just actually, it's funny, when I was just in Italy recently, and while I was there, a magazine in Italy came out that had some of my photos in it. And I went to a newsstand and picked it up, and I was looking, they did a 2-page spread with one of my shots. And I think I had sent them, I don't know, I must have sent them the full-size files. But that came out of my 12-megapixel camera, and it looks great.
Yeah.
In a print, and that's 300 DPI. You know, they have to print those at 300. So they might have had to upsize that a bit. But the software is so good now. I mean, honestly, that's one of the things that keeps me... I love the look of the files that comes out. It's a D3S is the body I shoot with. Mm-hmm. I love the look of the files. And it one of the things that keeps me shooting with it is that I've been playing around with, you know, resampling the files in just in Photoshop, not using... I know there's all the software out there now that says they do it with AI and whatever nonsense buzzword they use. But if you just resample in the Photoshop, you know, resize image, it's I can get like a 40 megapixel file and then I can't see any artifacts in it. So, I mean, I badly need glasses, but that's a whole other thing. But I can't see any artifacts in these files at blowing them up at more than 3 times the native size.
Michael, we don't have time to get into it now, but Ethan, Ethan will also go into the myth busting on what your settings should be for shooting video too.
Oh, I'm curious what that means.
Just going to leave that hanging.
Okay, all right.
That's for the next episode.
So Michael, have we solved your problem? Have you decided what you're going to do?
I'm going to make more spreadsheets and look at the cost. And not, like, I mean, you know, what's the cost of going all in on Sony bodies, lenses? What's the cost of going Canon? Eventually buying the new RF lenses. No, you haven't solved my problem. I need the color science from Panasonic, the autofocus from Canon, and something from Sony. I don't know. Maybe it's autofocus. I need to combine those.
All right, I think we did it.
Yeah.
All right.
Wow, Bruce just left.
Bruce is out of here. Well, thank you all for doing this. You're gonna.
I couldn't take any more.
All right. Well, Bruce is now unstable in more ways than one. So we're gonna let him go, and the rest of you all. But thanks for doing this. And
I'm sending you hugs, Bruce.
The Slow Ride Podcast, three idiots who are usually wrong.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the titanium of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast. It's like if David Vanderpool had a podcast.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the Zwift Racing of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, find the real advice.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the Arrow Helmet of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, sport leader coming through.
The Slow Ride Podcast, when's Lance gonna sue us?
The Slow Ride Podcast, the experts in French cycling.
The Slow Ride Podcast, official fan experience zone on Facebook.
The Slow Ride Podcast, the gravel bike of podcasts.
The Slow Ride Podcast, both vertically and horizontally compliant.
The Slow Ride Podcast. New episodes every Tuesday.